alcoholic. He should be scared. Damn near killed me. Life is dangerous, isn't it? That's right here. Is that it? The short people are taking over. So we lost a good one, didn't we? Yeah. We lost a really good one. We lost a few mediocre ones too, but we lost a really good one in Mr. Parker. And I just want to say his name out loud from the podium in the room. Keep him alive. We're going to be telling Charlie stories for a long time, aren't we? There's some really good ones. Ones that you can't tell from the podium. My sobriety date is March the 27th, 1985. I am very impressed by that. That's a hell of a long time. I don't think that was the plan for any of us, was it? Don't you sit around once in a while and just wonder, how the hell did I end up here? Still here after all these years. My sponsor's here, and which is kind of crummy. Just before the pandemic, the last trip I took before everything shut down, I flew up to Sonoma, Northern California, to speak at a men's banquet up there. And this guy picked me up at the airport, a guy about my age, older guy. And you could tell he'd been around AA a long time. You could just tell by his demeanor, very relaxed guy. And we get in the car, and this was maybe an hour's drive or so to the event. So we're just talking. And he asked me how long I'd been sober, and I told him 30-some years, whatever it was. And he said to me, I almost had 30 years. So you knew it was going to be an interesting conversation. And he told the story about met his wife in AA, and they got married. She's a sober woman, and he's heading up in retirement. Life's pretty good. You know, things are going well for him. And he's just kind of resting on these laurel things. You know, they tell we shouldn't rest on our laurels. First thing you have to, what the hell is a laurel? A laurel is a past achievement. When I got to AA, I didn't have any of those. So if I'm going to rest on them, I'm going to have to get some. So I can then rest on them and find out why that's not a good idea. This guy evidently had some laurels, and he was resting on them. And he's still going to meetings and stuff, you know, but he's just not as involved. He had a little surgery, they gave him some pain medication, he took too many, and he got drunk. How many times you heard that story? And it really got my attention for some reason. It was like listening to myself, you know, it really got my attention. And that night we had dinner together at the banquet, we talked some more. And at this time that he's telling me this story, he's a couple of years sober, he's got a commitment. He's driving the speaker around, you know, and he's really glad to be back in AA, and he didn't lose everything, but it was tough. It was, you know, it really got my attention. And I came back to LA, and I called my sponsor, and I said, Jay, how come you and I are still here? Good question. And the answer he gave me I wasn't expecting, which is frequent with him. And he said to me, which is true, he says, well, Bill, you and I have not lost our enthusiasm for it. I'm an old hippie from the 60s. Weird has always attracted me. And after all these years, I still find you all deliciously strange. And it's just a never-ending font of weirdness. And I've let you into my life, and you've just disrupted the entire food chain, man. It's like, and I'm still enthusiastic about it. And I think that's grace. That's not everybody's story. And the other part of that story, the front end of that story, is when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 37 years old. And I was on my second marriage, and I had two kids that were My daughter was the second set of two children. My daughter was 3 years old. My son was 4 months old. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and two things happened to me that are just pure luck, in my estimation. The first one is probably the most important. I just liked it. Not everybody's story. You know, I didn't want to be here. You know, I showed up on a Friday night in Hermosa Beach in April, late April, at a meeting called the Gong Show. A lot of people said it wasn't really an AA meeting. I went to it for 20 years. And I walked up there, and the meeting was full. It's a Friday night, and it's full. Who knew? Why would an AA meeting be full on a Friday night down by the beach in Southern California? And all the Harleys were parked out front, which was kind of intriguing. I wasn't expecting that. And I walked in there, and there was no seats left, and I had to stand in the back, and I didn't feel part of because I wasn't. I didn't know anybody. And Rocky Hudson was the secretary of the meeting. He had Rocky's 20 questions. Is the economy recovering faster than you? You know, stuff like he would rattle these things off. And their friends would get up at the podium. Nicknames are flying around. One guy got up at the podium, and they hooted at him so much he just sat back down. You know? Evidently, that guy was really well-loved, you know. And I got the joke right away. I heard the music right away, where we laugh at the tragedies and we cry at the successes. They don't do that down at the Rotary Club or the Kiwanis. This is an AA thing. And the reason we laugh at the tragedies is because it's not like that anymore, huh? Because when it's like that, it's not funny, you know. And I left that meeting that night, and I said to myself in the car driving home, this may not be so bad. 38 years later, it's still like that. I mean, I'm kind of used to it now. That was remember that first year you were sober? What a shock to the system that is, huh? I mean, sober is weird. They take away our medication. You know, everywhere I am is uncomfortable. It's all brand new. And I'm the guy that walks in the room, and if you're looking at me, it's, what the hell are you looking at? And if you don't look at me, I'm heartbroken. And there's like no middle ground, you know. The switch is either on or off. There is no depth of emotional striations, you know, here. And my sponsor said to me one time, he insulted me, and he said, oh, did I hurt your feeling? Because there's only one. So I banged around for a little bit, a couple of weeks, and I had to get one of these sponsor things, because they're always talking about the sponsor thing. And so I asked this guy to sponsor me. And the second lucky thing happened. I asked him to help me, and he actually did, which doesn't always happen. You know, doesn't always happen. And he said to me that night, he said, go home and read the doctor's opinion. Makes notes in the margin of what you agree with and what you don't. Be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock, and we'll discuss it. So we talk a lot around here often about the bottom. Like, what's the bottom? I hit bottom. And there's bottoms in sobriety, too. It's not just alcoholism. I mean, there's bottoms. And bottoms happen. And I think what the bottoms are is the collapse of the alibi system. You know? And the alibi system is it's someone else's fault, right? You can't take responsibility for your own behavior because it's indefensible. So you create an environment where it's other people's fault. You can't be an alcoholic and not know who they are. Right? And that collapses. Then there's a window of opportunity because it comes back, you know. And I just did what he told me. I went home and I read my assignment and I made my little notes and I showed up at the stranger's house Thursday at 5 o'clock. He let me in his place, and he did a very intimate thing with me. Not what you're thinking. And he sat down with me. He sat across from me in his living room. And he did not trust me that I'd read it, and he had me read it to him out loud. Now, over the years, that man and I have done workshops and retreats and stuff around a good hunk of the world. And one of the first rules of sponsorship is make sure they read the book. Don't trust them read it with them. It might help you out. And if I have to read, war fever ran high in that New England town. And now it's on Zoom. We're doing it, you know. All over the world. Isn't that amazing? I think the Zoom thing has given the world more access to Alcoholics Anonymous than it's ever had. And I'm really glad to be back live with you here. But I don't think it should go away, and I think it's been a net positive experience. It's been quite exciting, actually. And so each week I went to this guy's house, and we worked and read another chapter in the book. And he took me through that process. At 6 months sober, I did a fifth step. And I had one of those experiences that we have around here. I was talking to somebody about it just earlier, talking about Charlie, that hour after the fifth step. And what he told me after the fifth step, he said, go be quiet for an hour, reflect on what you've done. When you walk through the door of your house, think about the guy that walked through that door 6 months before that. Think about that. Stop and reflect. And I physically did that. I stood by the front door of my house because I'm not very creative. I just have a tendency to do what I'm told, which is very helpful sometimes. And I stood there and I thought about it and I had that experience. My God, it's going to be like this now. Evidently, the old life is over, whatever that was. That's a remarkable experience. Sometimes I think we forget that. And it took me 6 months because I'd been busy. I'd been busy taking everything personal and feeling uncomfortable. And my wife didn't like me very much, and there's a lot of really good reason for that, you know. And I was uncomfortable where I was uncomfortable everywhere, and I'm trying to get along because I don't have any medication. And my God, everything changed. Now, some years ago, I was sitting with a pretty big-time Indian guru. I was really impressed to be with this guy. A friend of mine was attached to him, and we went to hear him speak up in Hollywood. Then afterwards, we went back in this little room, and the three of us are just sitting there together. And I'm talking away like I do, and he starts laughing at me. And I said, what are you laughing at? He goes, I just love you, alcoholics and drug addicts. And I said, why is that? He goes, well, the rest of them out there are trying to get awakened. You're just trying to figure out what the hell happened. Isn't that true? What the hell happened? It wasn't like I took a course and passed it and got a grade, and now I've got a degree. You know, it just happens. Grace. Matthew Mitchell talks about grace. You know, something touched me on March the 27th, 1985, and it took me 6 months to realize that. And I think I'm clearer about what happened then now than I was back then, but it's clearly something changed radically. My life is not the same. I'm still the same person trying to figure out what the hell's going on. The transformation in me is going to take some decades, you know. But right then, everything had changed. I've never had the obsession since. I've come close a couple of times. I've had thoughts and stuff, but not the obsession. And I'd always had that. My story is, I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I rarely went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran, and I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me. But I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. All of you old dudes with long hair piss me off. Yeah. My biker nickname was Horny. I have it tattooed here on my arm, and it's misspelled. It's H-O-R-N-E-Y. Horny. With an exclamation mark for emphasis. For $5, I'll show it to you. So to know about me, isn't it? At 17, I was a bad drunk in high school. I had a big jacket and a slouch and a sneer and a foul mouth and a bad attitude, and I carried a gun. And I'm from the mean streets of Palos Verdes. There's no gangs in Palos Verdes. Nobody was looking for me. I was a gang of one. All of us talk about how we didn't feel part of. Some of us call that an aspect of alcoholism. I think it's just an aspect of being human. I think all kids feel that way. We all compare ourselves to somebody else and think we should be taller, or blonder, or shorter, or whatever. We all do that. You know, some of us more than others, but all of us do. That's not alcoholism. That's just being human. You know. So I think the whole idea of the drinking thing, if I remember correctly, you have a couple of pops and that sense of separation goes away. And you can talk to the girls and you can, you know, whatever, you do it. I think the idea was to get out of the house and go have some fun, wasn't it? I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. What the hell happened to the party, man, you know? I'm having sex, menage a uno. Next time some guy walks in one of your rooms and says, I'm just a party kind of guy, ask him how many other people were at the party you just left. We have a tendency to end up completely alone, you know, and that certainly happened to me rather quickly. At 22, I ended up in the Oregon State Mental Institution. Short party. You know, I had gotten married, went to Oregon to grow our own. It was the 60s. I was in San Francisco in during the summer of love. I was there, and I'm sorry I missed it. You know, I mean, I was busy, you know, and it was a wonderful time, actually. It was really quite an incredible time. And I had gotten married and had these two kids, and I was running with an outlaw motorcycle gang and sticking needles in my arm and drinking like a fish and not coming home to that family. They were on welfare, and it was awful. It wasn't funny. It was tragic. And I ended up in the Oregon State Mental Institution in Salem, Oregon. This is the mental institution that Ken Kesey worked on when he wrote Cuckoo's Nest. They filmed that movie on the ward I was on. The next time you see that movie, think of me. And I'm not bragging. It's just all I got. This is the high point of the drunkalogue. Some years ago, I was up and I spoke at a little conference they have in Salem, beautiful little city, and I was trying to find trying to drive in, and it was blocked off and different stuff. So I showed up at the dinner for the speakers and the committee, and I'm sitting next to this long-haired hippie dude that was about my age and had come up there around the time I did and just never left and got sober, had about the same time sober, you know, and I'm talking to him. I said, I was in the mental institution there, and he goes, oh, I worked there. I said, oh, of course you do. You know, where else? And he said, would you like to go see it? And I go, absolutely. So he called security. He says, we have a dignitary from the South. And I got in there and I found the ward and had my picture taken next to the sign. And, you know, like some people went to college. This was graduate school for Billy, you know. A couple years after that, I'm speaking at a meeting in Portland, and some of these guys I met in Salem rode their Harleys up to Portland, and they brought me a gift. It's one of my treasured gifts, and it's a t-shirt that says, Oregon State Hospital Alumni. So I came back down to California. Oregon thought I should leave. There was a lot of violence and stuff. It was awful. And my sober dad, that got sober in 1954, and when he died in 99, he was 45 years sober. He let me sleep in his garage, and he gave me a job in his little machine shop in El Segundo, California. And I tried to clean up my act. And what it looks like when you don't want to stop drinking is you got to quit shooting heroin because nobody can go along with the concept of social heroin use. There is no support for the position. And you got to quit taking acid because normal people have two-way communication with each other. And with LSD, you just don't need the other person. You got to cut that out. So what you do is you only drink on the weekends. And the reason you only drink on weekends is because normal people have jobs. And they go to them days in a row. I've watched them do it. And when I drink, I don't show up no matter what. My life stopped when I started drinking. I didn't really go anywhere or do anything. My life stopped. And when I drink, everything stops. And so what you do during the week is you smoke pot because it's green and it's from God and it's not really drugs. And because I don't know about you, but the impact of your personality on me is devastating. I cannot do you. I need something in me all the time to cushion the blow of you on me. I just don't get along. And I think what my problem is, I'm just really angry. I have no idea that I'm filled with fear. I don't know that. I'm not conscious of that. I'm just really angry. And that's the way I deal with all that. But that came years later to discover that's what was going on. And I met another woman because you can't ever be alone. It's a group effort getting me through life. It takes a village. And there are volunteers out there. Some of them are in Al-Anon now. And my friend Steve Lamb likes to say that if it wasn't for us, Al-Anon wouldn't exist. You know? But I met this woman, and we tried to make a life for ourselves. She hooked up with me, and we ended up getting married. We had two more kids. And 15 years after the mental institution, I'm in the house with that second wife and those two kids, and I have no emotional connection to another living human being. And I don't know that. I can't stand outside myself and have a separate experience and compare it to the one that I'm having to determine that there's anything wrong. I don't know that. And one night, I was up all night, because there's certain spiritual truths, right? One of them is, alcohol plus money equals cocaine. This is not an outside issue. It's an inside issue. And the reason God gave us cocaine is so that alcoholics could drink more. That's what it's for. The people that just do it all by itself, they have another program for those weirdos. You know? And so I'm up all night again. And I'm in my alcoholic chair. And I don't know about you, but when the sun comes up, that is some depressing stuff. I'm a vampire now. I don't want the sun to come up. And when the sun comes up, it's just painful. And my little daughter got up and was happy to see Daddy was up, and she crawled up in my lap, my little 3-year-old daughter, and it just broke my heart. Something cut through that fog, and it just broke my heart. And I think I was just really exhausted. And it was another... It's going to be another miserable day in a long, long line of miserable days. There's no more party. Nobody's knocking on my door to see if Billy can come out and play. And so like any good gangster, I called my mom. This is a woman that had been in Al-Anon for 30 years by this time. They are organized and prepared and focused. And she got there inside of a half an hour before I took the nap and changed my mind. Right? And she checked me into a place in Costa Mesa, California called Starting Point. And I spent 35 days in there. While I was in there, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. It was a little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it. And it said, "I am not a counselor." Evidently, there was some confusion about that. Then they let me out. They just let us out, don't they? Like we're okay now. Go forth, multiply. And where do we end up? Here. The world's aftercare program, Alcoholics Anonymous. When all the insurance money runs out, when they're all done gestalting and rolfing and primal screaming, they send you to us. We are the counselors, aren't we? I've been married 3 times. I've been to a lockdown mental institution with barbed wire on top of the fence place twice. And people ask me for relationship advice. I give it to them. Hell, you can't hurt them. They're an AA. True story, this guy comes to me, he says, I'm thinking about marrying the nude dancer. What do you think? Probably not a good idea. But if you do, I'll go to the wedding. He married her. It was awful. He's now married to a school teacher for many years. But he couldn't marry the school teacher unless he went through the nude dancer, right? Seems to be spiritual truth. So, it's 6 months sober. I do my inventory. I do a fifth step. And I start making amends. And I start sponsoring guys. At around a year sober, I start sponsoring guys officially. But I'm enthused. I'm intrigued. I just love it here. You know, I'm having a good time. In the first 10 years I was sober, I was working diligently to make a name for myself in an anonymous organization. But it served me well, because I did the work. I did it. Didn't matter what the motivation was, I did the work. So it says in our book, and this is what I would really like to talk about, which has really intrigued me for the last few years. It says that the only thing that's going to save us and give us a quality life and maybe some intimacy in our relationships, and I don't mean sex, I mean intimacy in our relationships. The only thing that's going to do that for us is the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Right? So evidently, I need to get one of those so I can maintain it. Right? And there's a process for that. And I asked myself here a while back, what is the spiritual condition? We work the steps, and there's some wonderful people like Charlie and many others that can talk to you about the mechanics of the steps and what it says and why we're doing what we're doing and why we should do it and the benefit that we get. And if you haven't gotten the benefit, what it is you missed, that's all good. But what about, what I want to talk about is, what is the effect of it? When I do these steps, and I've been sober a long time, almost 4 decades, and I can look back and I can see the phases that I've gone through. And I believe that what our primary problem is, the sense of separation, was it real? No, we can't possibly be separate. That's an illusion that we're separate. We're dependent upon each other. Not in a codependent way, but we are part of a larger whole. We're like a virus, you know. We're all connected like a fungus, you know. We're all in this together. And our very first tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous is our common welfare should come first. And isn't that what we feel here? Don't we feel connection here? I certainly do. I'm in a room full of people right now, many of which are sober a long time. Most all of you are very aware of the fact that your life has been saved. Not by you. Now there's an energy around that I've always been able to feel and tap into. I think now I'm attempting in my own halting way to define that. You know, what is that? What is it we share? If we really are one of the most significant social movements of the 20th century and maybe the 21st, what's different? And there are some marked differences between us and other organizations. So the very first thing that this man wanted to know from me when I sat down in the living room that day is, are you powerless over drugs and alcohol? Do you know what alcoholism is? Let's read the doctor's opinion, and I'm going to ask you some questions. What kind of alcoholic are you? Do you think you're powerless? Now, for me, that was an easy answer. I was beat up. 30 years later, it almost killed me. I didn't know how sick I was. But I could answer to the affirmative. 38 years sober, it's clearly everything. They bullshitted us. They didn't want us to run screaming down the street, so they just said it was drugs and alcohol. It's everything, isn't it? I've lost complete control over the geopolitical situation in the world. Look at it. It doesn't matter what side you're on. You know, I'm powerless over that. I shut off the TV news 3 years ago. I couldn't deal with it. I realized I was polarized as the people I was pissed off at. I'm powerless over all that. I talk to you incessantly about how if you were a little bit different, the two of us would be a hell of a lot happier. And you insist upon living your own life, and it pisses me off at my core. I went to the relationship workshop today. Went to two of them, actually. I figured you needed my help. You know. But I'm powerless over my wife. I'm powerless over other people. I have nothing. I'm totally powerless. Lack of power is not my dilemma. My real dilemma is I think I have some power, and I keep asserting myself, and things don't change, and I suffer. I believe that things outside myself need to be different in order for me to be okay. You are the source of all my problems. You are responsible for how I feel and how I behave. If you didn't do the things that you did, I wouldn't need to straighten you out. So you're responsible for the fact that I'm angry because of what you did. If you didn't do that stuff, I wouldn't be angry, right? And then when I respond to you, now you're responsible for my behavior too. How's that working out for you? I went to my sponsor one time. I got into a screaming fight with my wife because she said something wrong. And I lost it. I had one of my seizures, right? And I ran over to his house and I told him what she had said to me, what she did. And he said, "Stop yelling at your wife." So I had to re-explain it. I don't yell at her from a vacuum. I mean, she's not just sitting there passively and then I just start screaming at her. She did something. People do shit. And it needs to stop. And he just kept repeating himself, "Stop yelling at your wife." He wasn't interested in what happened, only in my behavior. AA's man school, isn't it? Isn't it man school? You know, it's man school. And I drove away from his house that day going, "This is not therapy. What have I walked into? Everybody else is always interested in how I feel and what I think about how I feel." You know? They would say things to me like, "High school is over." "All you need to know about your childhood is it's over." And it was extraordinarily long, well into my 40s. You know? So powerlessness seems to be the first pillar of spiritual condition. Any mystical path that you go down talks about this. Doesn't matter what discipline they come from. They all talk about personal powerlessness. All you need to know about God is it's not you, right? So powerlessness seems to be the first pillar of spiritual condition. I somehow have to get a grasp of that. And over the years, it's become to be a much deeper thing than just drugs and alcohol. The second step then becomes operational. I need to align myself with the power. People have trouble with God. I had a problem with God. I said, "I don't believe in God." And Jay told me, he said, "I don't believe in the God you don't believe in either." These things are confusing. Because everybody knows what you don't believe in. You know? Evidently not. You know. And, Bill Wilson wrote a lot about the second step. He talked about open-mindedness. Acknowledge the fact I am not in charge, and that's very clear. And I keep asserting myself, and I don't get a higher pay grade. Then the third step becomes operational. Now, the third step's interesting. It says I'm going to make a decision to turn my life and will over to clearly what already has it anyway. I think it was nice of them to lead us to believe that we actually have some say in the matter. "Well, I've been withholding myself from the totality of all things long enough. I'm going to acquiesce now and allow you to take me. Thank you very much. Where's my trophy?" And we have these long-winded discussions about the difference between my will and God's will. as if that's really possible. You know, my little ego that presented itself at 2.5 years old, like every other living human being on the planet, nothing, it presents, it loves the idea of us having a battle of wills with the power that drives the entire universe. You know? And what is God's will? That's a mystery, isn't it? I think you know what God's will is what's happening right now. What else could it possibly be? And I don't like what's happening right now. I'm looking for an alternative. So let's have a discussion about God's will. That'll go somewhere. You know? And what life and will is the third step talking about? It's the inventory, isn't it? The end result of living a life with seeming power. Resentment, fears, and broken sexual relationships. What I bring to you. The junk of my life. And I make the list. I write it out. And I share it with this stranger. With me and this God I don't believe in. Here's my stuff. The other thing about the third step, you know, now when I'm going to do a third step with a guy, I say, are you ready to do the third step? And the guy goes, no. I go, why not? He says, well, I have a problem with God. I go, so do I. Let's pray. He says, well, I don't believe in him. Believe in God. And I go, nobody really does. You know, we're all just whistling in the dark, hoping for the best. What do you say we pray? I don't know about you. I've kind of run out of options. When you get a few years sober, we'll sit here in the ashram and talk about non-duality and Eastern and stuff like that. You know, we'll do all that. Right now, let's just pray. So I do the inventory and I do the fifth step and I have the experience, right? Well, what's the lesson in the fifth step? The second pillar of spiritual condition. I have to stop blaming other people and institutions for my problems. High school is over, right? It's time for little Bill to start taking responsibility for his own life. And that's going to take a while. But this opens the door to that. Because what we're looking for in that inventory, especially in that resentment list, is what are my faults and mistakes? It's not about the other people, is it? It's about us. We're looking at us. And it's not an explanation of why we did what we did, although that first inventory has a lot of that in it. This son of a bitch hit me with a 2x4. What did you? Well, I slept with his wife. But this still doesn't justify the 2x4 thing. You know? Sometimes there is a part, but sometimes we just have faults and mistakes. Sometimes at very least we're unforgiving. We won't let go of it. It's part of who we are, right? Some of the really good resentments are part of who you are. You ever hated somebody really good? Really hate them really good. For really good reason. Then on a particular day, you forget to hate him. And the following day, you got to hate him extra to make up for the day you skipped. That's some of the really good resentments, you know. I have to stop blaming those people. And then we get into the amends process. These people that I'm angry at, that I hate, and one that you want me to go make amends to them in order to rid myself of these amends, these resentments. And I'm not going to do that. I don't want to see that. My friend Steve Lamb says, I know it's their money, but I've been hanging on to it for a long time. You know, some of them don't even know I have it. You know? But I don't want to do that. It scares me to do that. This is where a lot of people stop. Sometimes you talk to a guy who's been sober a while and he's having some problems, and you ask him, have you made the amends? And he'll answer like, well, I'm making living amends. What that means is, no, I haven't made the amends. That's a chicken gate, you know. But I do it. I go to these people. And when I go to somebody that I don't ever want to see again, and I look them right in the eye, and I say the words that need to be said, in whatever format you do this in, when I turn and walk away from that, I am changed right then and there. No waiting. This is a cathartic experience. The action of doing that will change me as a person. That experience of doing that. This is real life experience. This is real stuff. Some of the best stories in Alcoholics Anonymous are amends stories. They're heartfelt, sometimes heartbreaking. But this changes us. This is transformation. And the third pillar of spiritual condition happens. The lesson that comes out of the amends process is nothing was ever personal. And it sure seemed personal, didn't it? But nothing was ever personal. People are just doing what they do, and I happen to be in the blast radius of their behavior. And sometimes you're in the blast radius of my behavior, and you're just the next victim in line. I'm just doing what I do. I can't help myself. Nothing was ever personal. Sandy Beach used to say, there's my story, and then there's what really happened. In the amends process, you get closer to what really happened. You realize, because we apply motivation to people. I hated my father. I hated him. He didn't like me much either. I was an awful kid. It was really awful. And I hated him. And I applied motivation to what he did unconsciously, that he was out to get me. He was after me for some reason. And I made amends to him, and I had one of those experiences that we have. I knew I had to do it. He was at the top of the list. And I knew I had to do it. And on his 70th birthday, I went to his house. And he's been sober a long time, right? He's been in AA. And I take him in the other room, and he says to me, you don't need to do this. And I said, you better than anybody know that I do. Get in the room. And he went right in the room, sat down. He was as nervous. I think he was more nervous than I, because I don't think he ever did this stuff. You know, he was like shook up. And I told him, essentially what I told him is, I know that I wasn't the son that you wanted me to be. I'm not going to list all the stuff. You were there, you know. And I'm just really sorry for the way I treated you, the way I spoke to you. You're my father, and I love you, and I don't want to hate you anymore. And I went out in the car after that, and I broke down. It was like something reached inside of me and just pulled all that rage out. Maybe not all of it, but I started crying and couldn't stop. It had a physical response to that. It had a physical response. And I started looking at him completely differently after that. He got sober on March the 28th. I got sober on March the 27th. In the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, we gave each other birthday cakes for the last 15 years of his life. And if I found my dad in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was kind of an asshole, you know. But he wasn't the kind of asshole that I thought he was, you know. And he was really funny. And I got to see him around other men, which I'd never seen before. And I said, he'd tell sex jokes about my mother. I go, dude, that's my mother. People would look at me and I go, it's not my fault. I'm not responsible. We had a great time. We found each other. And when he died, I changed his diapers and I took care of him with my mother. And when at the end, nothing more needed to be said. It all had been said. 10 years after I made amends to him, when it was safe and I didn't need it, he made amends to me. And he didn't do a very good job, but he did it. Isn't that cool? Thank God I didn't miss that. Thank God I didn't go to my grave or him going to his grave with that hatred we had for each other. Thank God for that. What a gift of grace. You know, that changed my life. It changed his life, too. I mean, he came into an AA that he'd never experienced before. And nothing's personal. The story changes. The story that I've always told, or the one that I had in my head, changed. It wasn't the way that I thought it was. I heard a guy say one time, my God, I was so wrong. That's how I felt. Now, there comes a time in this spiritual path that we're on. Usually, I think it's around the 10th step, right around the fourth pillar. When you stand there and you say, oh my God, it's me. It was never them. It's me. Self-awareness without humor is depression. AA does a really good job at helping us laugh at who we think we are, the persona. Now, when these first three things come together, the powerlessness, I can't blame anymore. I'm still doing it, but I feel bad about it now. I'm trying to quit. It's going to take a while because it's so ingrained in me. I mean, on my first inventory was the entire federal government and specifically the Department of Motor Vehicles. Who the hell are they to tell me what to do? And that kind of anger and rage, blaming other people, those people, them and all that stuff. And I realized that nothing was ever personal. That's the collapse of the egoic structure of who I think I am. This is the collapse of my personality. This is not necessarily a happy moment. It's difficult when you realize this thing. 1 through 9 is about 10% of the program. It's the bare minimum. It's not really the work. It's what we have to do to develop a message with some depth and weight to begin the real work in Alcoholics Anonymous. 90% of it is in 10, 11, and 12. 90% of it is making amends in the present moment. Because I get it now. I get it. It's going to take a while, but I'm starting to get it now. When I walk down the street and I step on your foot, I turn around and say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. I don't have to go down to the Ilano Club and share at the noon meeting, write 3 pages of inventory, talk to my sponsor and 2 other people, track you down 2 weeks later and apologize. I get it now. I get it. The fourth pillar of spiritual condition is self-awareness as compared to self-obsession. A fine line, but a big difference, where I can watch myself move through life now, making amends in the present moment. I realize things now. I see things differently now. The psychic change has occurred. My perceptual change, the way I see the world, has changed. The first time I go through it, no, I don't think so, not the first time. Second time, third time, fourth, you know. I mean, it's an ongoing process, isn't it? Things change, life changes, life gets bigger. We have a tendency to drift away, then we come back, and we go through all of this stuff, and we keep working this thing. We think we've done it already. Do I have to do it again? Yes. Yes. It's an ongoing process. In the meditation, in the 11th step, when I meditate, I can watch myself think. I can focus my mind on my breath going in and out of my nose. And the ego that thinks it's me, and I think it's me, I'm in collusion with it, right? It doesn't like being in the present moment because there's nothing for it to do. There's never anything wrong in the present moment. Everything is just absolutely as it should be. How could it possibly be any different than it is? Unless you start thinking about it. And it will wander away from the breath. And you notice that it has wandered away and you gently bring it back to the breath. This, to me, is absolute conclusive proof that the essence of who I am is not my thinking mind. There must be another consciousness within me that can watch that one operate, or I couldn't catch it. This is a game-changing experience. And one of the real precepts of AA, sometimes I think we all lose track of this, because now I understand this, I can finally stop working on myself. I'm just feeding the beast. It'll take any kind of attention it can get. I'm much better off when I'm thinking about you. I'm much better off. I mean, just in a healthy way, I'm much better off. All the ego does is it take the past and project it into the future. We say, my head is out to get me. We actually talk about it in the third person. And we make it adversarial because that's who we are. We need to kill it, crush it, stab it, burn it, torture it for a while first, you know. Talk about it to everybody about it. But it's not trying to hurt me. It needs me for transportation. You know? This is not a conspiracy. It's not trying to hurt me. It thinks it's me. It's kind of flat and two-dimensional. It has no depth. It creates nothing. It just takes credit for shit. You know? It just takes the past and projects it into the future. And what I've learned from that is I don't necessarily have to go where it wants to take me. Isn't that something? I mean, the other day I was walking in the street in my neighborhood. I try to do a lot of walking. And it came up with this creepy thing I did when I was 9 years old. And I'm thinking about it. And I stopped in the middle of the street and I said out loud, really? You want to think about that? Really? What am I supposed to do with that? I'm not 9 anymore. I'm not there. I don't even know if that really happened or not. But I seem to remember it. Maybe you're just telling me that. And I said, thanks for sharing. I know you're trying to help, but I'm just going to move on with my day now. And I just looked at the asphalt in front of me and I just kept walking. This is where I am. I'm just walking. You know? Why does it come up with that? You know? And it continues. It doesn't go away. But I can tell you this, as the years have gone by, this meditation practice really helps. Just the awareness really helps. I realize it's not who I am. It's part of me, though. And it's not going to go away. I can't shut it off, but I can watch it. So the final pillar, the thing that's missing in me, I can see the character defects. I'm not stupid. I can see it. I know that I'm arrogant. I know that I'm pompous. I know that I'm preachy. I know these things about myself. You know, I've always constantly want to be the center of attention. It's like now you'll hear some speakers say, I hate doing this. I'm the only one facing this way. Don't believe it. Bullshit. We love this or we wouldn't do it. I mean, you're all sitting quietly looking at me and I'm hearing myself talk. What's not to like about that? You know? I mean, let's be honest about it, you know. It's a gift from God, you know. My problem is, why do I think I need more attention than I already get? That's the problem. I think there's a problem in that. Why do I always need to be the center of attention? And over the years, that's changed. Sometimes it's your turn. Sometimes it's your turn. But what I'm missing, because I'm so self-centered, that never developed in me, so I don't know it's not there, because I've never experienced it. Some things maybe I've lost and I want to regain them. But what about stuff that never developed in me, because I've never matured? I missed all those lessons when I was in middle school and high school because I was hammered. Right? It's compassion. That's what's missing. I'm not capable of intimacy. The only time I'm concerned about how you feel is when how you feel impacts me in some way. Then I'm concerned. I really do not connect with you, and I don't know that I'm not connected. Have you ever had somebody stand in front of you and look you right in the eye, and you've been sober some years, and say to you, in one form or another, you are not emotionally available for me? Anybody heard that? There's a bunch of you saying, no. You know what they mean by that when they say that is, I've got something that they want and I'm withholding it. And the truth is worse. I don't have it. And I don't know that I don't have it. You've convinced me that I've got it and I'm helping you look for it. And this dance is going to go on forever. Right? That happened to me at around 10 years sober. And I looked at her and I go, what the hell are you talking about? I'm standing right here. Because I don't get it, because I don't have it. Alcoholics Anonymous does a really good job of developing this in us, and the mechanism that's used for that is sponsorship. Working with others, trying to help, literally trying to get out of self. You'll hear us say sometimes that if you're a newcomer, reach out and ask us for help. Don't you think it's up to us to reach out to them? Isn't that why we are here? Right? Sometimes we forget because it's become very social. I'm sitting there, you know, talking to you. Some new guy comes up and wants to talk to me, and I'll, hey, look, I'm smoking my cigar with my buddies, man, talking politics. Don't bother me. You know, I don't say that. But sometimes that's what happens, and I have to catch myself and remind myself, why am I here? The most important fifth step you'll ever be involved in is the first one you listen to. Right? Everything changes when that happens. The game begins. The work begins when that happens. That's when the real work begins. Sober 101, the first semester is over. Now we're getting into the meat and bones. You know, now this is where it happens. This is the on-the-job training. You want to disrupt your life and change your life? Let them all in. I used to say, just answer the phone when it rings. Don't look to see who it is, because we can weed everybody out now, you know. Except for spam risk. Don't answer that one. You know? And whatever they ask you to do, just say yes. I think the most spiritual thing that you hear in AA is get in the car. You know, where are we going? What do you care? What's on your social agenda? You know? I lived in Los Angeles all my life. All my life. First time I ever went to Skid Row is when I joined AA. Why would I go there? There's poor people there. You know? And it changed my life. Went down there for years, you know. And I start working with you. When I ask him for help, he sends me you. I gave a guy one time a 20-minute lecture on how he should live his life. And he left, and I thought to myself, that is some good shit. I'm going to record that and hand that out to all my guys, right? Then the next thing I thought is, maybe I should even do some of it. I called Jay, and I said, Jay, I think I'm a hypocrite. He goes, oh, no, it's worse than that. You're a liar. prejudice you have will walk across the room and ask you for help. If you want to hang on to it, send it away so you can hang on to it. Because if you let it in, you'll find yourself in it. And it'll change everything. One day this guy walked across the room years ago and he asked me to help him. He said, I think I should tell you that I'm gay. I said, wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor? And he says, no, he says, I got the gay thing down pretty good. Alcoholism is kicking my ass. It's a true story. I guess I thought something else, you know, I don't know. And I became very close to that guy. Years later, he got killed in an ATM robbery, broke my heart. Just broke my heart. And so whatever prejudice you have, whatever, you let him in. We are people who normally would not mix. But we mix here, don't we? We mix here. We sit in meetings together. My wife said to me not too long ago, I had some guy over there in the backyard talking to him, and she looked, the guy, he was pretty creepy looking. And she goes, do you screen these guys before you... We should have an AA screening service, don't you think? Okay, you got to go talk to those guys first before I let you come to my house. Compassion. And isn't that what we felt when we came to AA? People were just kind. Weren't you suspicious at first? You know, Jay used to say he was looking for the tambourines under the chairs and when they were going to start asking for money. And people were just kind to me. There was this guy, Big Larry, stood outside the Ilana Club and talked to me for 45 minutes one night. I left there thinking, that guy really likes me. Later, I realized that Larry just needed any warm body in front of him. He would just talk. You know, but can you imagine how many lives that man saved by being that way? By being friendly? Just being friendly, being open and kind. People were just kind to me. People, in all my arrogance and all my pomposity that first 10 years, I had a lot of amends to make inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there were a lot of people that did not want to break my spirit, but they just very kindly told me to shut the hell up. You know, it's like... But I could tell they loved me. In a 10-year sober, I cheated on my wife, ran off with a woman in AA, blew up my whole family. Ended up living in a storeroom over my office. My fall from grace was very public. It hurt. I was in more emotional pain than I've ever been in my life. And I didn't run away from AA, but I wanted to. I was embarrassed to walk back in the room. And I walked back into my home group one night, and Mike Plank, this guy, was there. And he saw me and a big smile on his face. And he came over and he threw his arms around me and he whispered in my ear, he says, welcome to AA. We've been waiting for you. And then he laughed hysterically and walked out of the room. I think that's love. But it really hurt. You know? But he didn't throw me away. Some people didn't throw me away. Some did, you know. But a lot of people didn't throw me away. You're going to be okay. Just don't run away, kid. Don't run away. You'll be all right. And I did a big inventory. And I started looking at it, and it was, oh my God, it's me. It was that moment, that self-awareness, oh my God, it's me. And I started praying and meditating with some intent. With intent, because I need spiritual help. I need help. You will reach a point, all of us in this program, where you'll be reduced to prayer and meditation. Nothing else will work. Doesn't matter what you believe in. And if we have a problem with God, isn't it true that what we do is we create a God and then don't believe in it? Isn't that true? Because we're caught up in the concept. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we experience it here. It will come and visit you. And you can label it with whatever you feel comfortable with. But it will visit. It has visited me. And I try to not get hung up in concepts anymore. I just want to feel connected to it. And I think what it is everything. It's everything. And we somehow feel that we're separate. And that's the illusion. You know? So, we are in a program here, ladies and gentlemen. Gentlemen and gentlemen. Where people's lives are saved every day. And the mechanism that's used for that is us. We are the instrument of God's will. And I believe that's literally true. This is how it operates. Should everybody sponsor people? There is nothing else to do. Everything else is an activity. The real action is doing that. However it manifests itself in your life, we all do it differently. Some people can hear my voice. Someone's waiting for your voice. Be attentive to that. The time comes when we start going to meetings to see what we can bring to it rather than what we can get out of it. I'll leave you with this thought. They say here that you've got to give it away to keep it. No. You have to give it away to even get it. That's how you get it, is by giving it away. Thanks so much for having me here. This has been really wonderful.